Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our News Editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
This week, we're talking in detail about Tenet, with spoilers, for those of you who have already seen it. But don't worry, that is on a separate spoiler cast, so you can't accidentally find out here that Tenet actually is a sequel to Inception. We're joking, of course. But if you'd like to get involved in the discussion of what it might all mean, please look out for our Tenet spoiler cast now. Moving back to this podcast, in this time loop, we'll be appraising Disney's live-action Mulan, gritty indie Les Miserables, not that one, and getting a hurting head from Charlie Kaufman's latest, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. First up, though, we do need to talk about Chadwick Boseman and the legacy he left after dying this week at the age of just 43.
I cannot stay here with you. I cannot rest while he sits on the throne. He is a monster of our own making. I must take the mantle back. I must right these wrongs.
So obviously this was a major shock when we heard earlier this week that Chadwick Boseman had died from colon cancer. What did you think?
Exactly same as you. I was in complete shock when I saw on Saturday morning. I obviously had no idea he was ill. He seemed like he was, very much in his prime. And then it was, this kind of double whammy where it was this kind of shock and sadness, but also this kind of inspiration that he'd managed to do so much great work when he was facing such a kind of terrible illness and, kind of did everything with sort of such dignity and gravitas. He just looks so fit as well,
yeah.
Those films are so sort of physically fit. I'm just amazed he was able to do that.
Even just on a physical level, it's astonishing he even got out of bed and got to work, let alone was Black Panther when he was so poorly. What do you think he actually left behind in terms of work, Jordan?
I think everyone recognised he was a special actor, but the thing that I perhaps didn't fully appreciate until I watched, all the videos that people were sharing on social media over the weekend of, his Howard commencement address or that just heartbreaking press conference where he breaks down while he's talking about children with cancer. It's just how much of a man on a sort of righteous mission he was in terms of his career and his life in general. You just have to look at his filmography to see that. He'll be remembered primarily for Black Panther, of course, because of just how influential that film was. But he was really committed to telling Black stories on screen. He excelled at playing Black icons, real-life Black icons. His breakthrough role on film was 42, where he played Jackie Robinson, the first African-American to play Major League Baseball. He played James Brown in Get On Up, where he actually went full method and stayed in character throughout the shoot, which is amazing. And then, even a year after Civil War, where he debuted as T'Challa, he played Thurgood Marshall in Marshall, who was the first African-American Supreme Court justice. So he leaves behind this legacy of telling stories of Black excellence on screen, even above and beyond Black Panther.
He seems to have done it with a great deal of grace. And no, obviously, when people die, lots of people say nice things about him. But it does seem to his friends and colleagues that he actually worked with that he sort of brought that gravitas to his, 9-to-5, that he actually sort of believed and lived as he sort of acted in film.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that remarkable story that's been doing the rounds about how he brought T'Challa to the screen in Civil War, because there was a thought early on in that film that T'Challa should speak with a British accent or a European accent, which would imply, white supremacy or that colonialism has somehow touched Wakanda. But he pushed back against this and, stressed that T'Challa should speak with an authentic African accent and actually speak in the Xhosa language. You basically wouldn't have had that without Chadwick Boseman, and that would have been a major stumble, which would have, could have completely hobbled the authenticity of that universe. There's been a big push for diversity and representation in the MCU and beyond in recent years, and I see that as a direct consequence of the success of Black Panther and what Chadwick Boseman did with that film. Simu Lee, the star of Shang-Chi, which is coming out next year, he said himself on Twitter that, Marvel wouldn't be making that film, which is predominantly made by an Asian cast, without the success of Black Panther and what Boseman brought to that film. And I don't think it's even too much of a stretch to say that you wouldn't have, you know, John David Washington as the main character in a movie like Tenet without Chadwick Boseman proving that films with black leads can go on to be box office behemoths. I mean, Black Panther is the highest grossing solo superhero film ever. Mm-hmm. And it's the fourth highest grossing film ever at the American box office. And I mean, that just says everything about that film.
Led by a very fine captain. He achieved so much in a short time, and it's a legacy he should be very proud of.
God made your ears. You didn't make them. You gonna argue with God's ears? If it sound good and it feel good, then it's musical. So play it like I say play it. From the top. Hit it!
Okay, let's move on to what we can watch this week.
What is your name, soldier?
Hua Jun, Commander, son of Hua Zhou.
We're going to make men out of every single one of you. Close the gate!
Your spirit is evident. But something holds you back.
When they find out who you are, they will show you no mercy.
This is Mulan, which is available on Disney Plus. It was supposed to be coming out in cinemas, but it's on Disney Plus now. Matt, what's it about?
So this is Disney's latest live-action adaptation of an animated film from their back catalogue. So following in the recent tradition of the likes of The Lion King, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, etc. And as you mentioned, yeah, supposed to come out in cinemas in March, got pushed back a couple of times. And so now Disney have decided in most territories to give it this premium video on demand release where you can get it for an extra fee on the Disney Plus streaming service. And yeah, if you don't know the story, it's based on ancient Chinese folklore about the character Mulan, who's this young woman who disguises herself as a boy and goes and joins the Imperial Army when the Emperor kind of decrees that one man from every family's got to join because they need to help fend off these invaders who are attacking from the north. And this was previously adapted by Disney in 1998. And for me, generally, these adaptations generally work best when there's a human at the center. So for example, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, even Jungle Book kind of work better for me than things like The Lion King or Dumbo or Lady and the Tramp. So does Mulan fit this rule? I'd say sort of is the answer. I found it to be perfectly fine, if never kind of really, truly exciting.
Oh, well, that's disappointing. Mm. And there's no dragon, obviously. You've lost that. Did they take other things out to make this more believable as a live action?
In a way, yeah. It does feel cinematic. Like, there's a lot of films that have ended up going to streaming during the pandemic that feel like, you know, maybe they would never have been the biggest cinema hit anyway, so, you know, doesn't do them the biggest disservice to go straight to streaming. But this does feel very cinematic. There's some battle scenes which feel big and feel like you've got a lot of extras there. There feels like there's a lot of scale to everything. You get some quite epic sort of, you know, horse charges and things like that, which are always nice in a kind of epic way. But yeah, for me, it felt like it fell between two stools in a way, because it wasn't as fun as you kind of expect from a Disney family movie. Like you say, the songs have gone. Like, we have Christina Aguilera doing a couple of songs over the credits, but there's no songs during the film. And Mushu, the little dragon who was voiced by Eddie Murphy in the cartoon, is also just completely absent. So it's not quite fun enough, especially I'd say for like the much younger children. It feels very sort of serious in that way. Yeah, and I feel like also if you wanted a real genuine sort of, you know, martial arts epic with that kind of sweep, you're more likely to go for something from Zhang Yimou or like, you know, revisit Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or something like that. It feels a bit too serious for kids, but it doesn't feel like kind of perhaps cool enough for anyone older who's looking for a serious martial arts epic.
Do you think it's worth £20 on Disney Plus?
I mean,
for 20 quid, you get to show the whole family this story. It's not bad value on that level.
Yeah, and it does feel like a premium product in that sense. Like I mentioned, obviously, the scale and the battle scenes, and there's a nice sort of reprise of this avalanche moment from the animation that comes back, and that's a very sort of spectacular scene. And perhaps I sounded too negative in there, in that it's perfectly watchable, but I just felt like it never really rose above fine. Mm. And one of the issues for that for me was Liu Yifei, who plays Mulan. I found her a little bit flat, and there's kind of this aspect where she has to suppress her personality because she's disguising herself as a boy and she needs to kind of blend into the army. But maybe she sort of does that a bit too well. And like, she's not really like a bad actress per se. And, you know, she's very convincing with the physical stuff and also very kind of graceful with it. But she's just not that kind of protagonist that really draws you in and you really kind of care for and root for, and doesn't ever really have that presence, I find, for a role like this to truly work. Like, the villains kind of fare a bit better. Like, you've got Jason Scott Lee, who's kind of leading the invasion as Bori Khan. There's not loads of depth to him, but he has like a really cool badass look to him, and he has a lot of fun with the role and feels kind of larger than life, unlike, you know, some of the rest of the film. And Gong Li also, she's kind of on his side as well, and she plays this sort of shape-shifting sorceress who's also with him, and she's fun as well and brings something nice to the film. But yeah, it just never kind of really truly soars for me.
So it's a recommendation. It's a maybe recommendation. We're not highly recommending. We're not saying it's terrible. But if you enjoy Mulan and you've enjoyed the animated version, then maybe this is worth shelling out for you and the family.
Yeah, I think you'll know if you're going to be interested. And like I said, it's not like it's a huge disappointment. And I kind of respect that they did something a bit different with it, and they didn't just go for the shot-for-shot remake that they do with some of these adaptations. But at the same time, yeah, I think maybe this is one that could have benefited from just injecting a bit of the fun that you get from the animation into this version.
Cool. And that is available on Disney Plus from this Friday. Okay, shall we move on to something completely different? It's this.
Ici, c'est notre vie. Toi, tu débarques, nous, ça fait 10 ans qu'on est là. On est les seuls à se faire respecter.
Eh hey, les gars, soleil.
Ceux qui te respectent, tu me parles. Les gens d'ici, ils ont peur de vous, c'est tout.
So that is Les Miserables, which is not the all-singing, all-dancing Hugh Jackman looking right in his mouth version. This is a different version. Explain what this one's about, Jordan.
Well, neither is it based on the 19th century Victor Hugo novel, of course. This is, in fact, French filmmaker Lige Lee's drama, which actually debuted at Cannes last year, last May, but it's only just getting a release over here, thanks to COVID-19. The title actually comes from the fact that it's set in the Parisian suburb of Montfermeil, which is where Victor Hugo wrote Les Miserables over a century ago. As a film, it has a lot more in common with films like Matthew Kassovitz's La Haine than it does with Jean Valjean warbling about bread or whatever. There's also a healthy dollop of Training Day in here, actually, because we mainly follow Stefan, who's a new transfer to Montfermeil's anti-crime brigade. He's shown the ropes by these two rather unsavory colleagues, and their job is to sort of patrol the streets and keep the peace between, you know, rival gangs and errant kids, essentially by any means necessary. Tensions start to rise when a lion cub is kidnapped from this sort of traveling circus, and it basically explodes into violence when a member of the anti-crime brigade commits an act of malpractice, we'll say, which is caught on camera by a young man with a drone, which basically leads to these rival factions doing what they can to get hold of the footage, and it all boils over from there.
Just to be clear, the lion cub doesn't explode. It's the tensions that do.
No.
Because that would be even more traumatic than you were describing. As you say, this is, you know, in parts Training Day, this sort of idea of this newbie on the block who's just joined this task force. We're sort of viewing them through his experience of this sort of training. And the training seems to be just be a dick. be toxic in your masculinity, be racist, abuse your police powers, just be horrible. Even the female police officer at the headquarters, you know, she's sort of touching up her staff and at the same time saying she will not have inappropriate behavior. It's completely sort of fluid what is right and what is wrong. And that, for me, that just the setup of this before it even gets to a sort of incendiary level is incredibly tense to watch.
The film really sort of worked on two levels for me. You have this thriller aspect, this incredibly tense, just breathless explosion of violence basically towards the end, but it's also a real sort of issues movie. It sort of really has something to say. There's a really remarkable authenticity and veracity to what Lee has put on screen. He's actually lived in Montfermeil for most of his life, and he made a documentary about his experience of the 2005 riots from his bedroom window, basically. Mm. And several of the incidents in the film are actually drawn from his own experiences in real life, most notably the ending, which we won't go into here for fear of spoilers. And the incident where he actually captures the police malpractice on camera, he was that young boy who captured that incident on camera, and he went to the police to report this, and he was threatened to never show this footage, basically. And he went to the media after. These are all things that are drawn from real experience, and I think you can feel that veracity on screen.
Yeah, and it even opens it by putting you very firmly in a real situation. And with the celebrations last summer when France played Croatia and the sort of celebrations in the street as the football fans were sort of out and cheering and up the Champs-Élysées, it's very much rooted in current events and reality that we read about in the newspaper, all put into this very sort of high intensity drama.
If I had one problem with the film, is that I think there's probably a bit too much focus on the cops over the rest of society in Montfermeil, particularly because, you know, for the most part, the cops are the people causing the problems. So it felt a little off that they were often more humanized than some of the children or the members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, there's an argument that, you know, Lahen did this 25 years ago, but that's sort of the point, I guess. These things haven't gone away.
Yeah,
exactly. Mm. You can still tell the same story, and it's still just as powerful and effective. And effectively, by it being such an echo of that film, it hits even harder.
Yes, we haven't really moved on. And let's talk about the performances here. I mean, we talked about those police guys. I love the fact that they don't try to soften them. Really, they are unrepentant and unpleasant and unkind to each other as well, talking about what they've done to each other's wives as a morning greeting, etc.
I just like the way that Stefan, he gets that nickname Greaser. Like, they take the mickey out of his hair as soon as he starts, and then in that kind of, like you say, that sort of toxic way, it just sticks to the whole film. He just calls him Greaser for the rest of the film.
It's just a very unpleasant atmosphere to work in.
It was one of those films that was interesting for me. When you are following Stefan, it's one of those films that asks that weird, how far would you go along with something, you know, that you're, when you're kind of brought into a group like this, and there's these authoritative guys who've been doing it for a while, and they're intimidating people as well. And as more and more pennies kind of drop with their sort of inappropriate behavior, that just kind of seemingly escalates. And, you know, he's obviously doing what he can to pull them away from it. Yeah, I thought that side of it was really interesting as well. And just, it's just really kind of tense and just gets going straight away. And then I fully understand why they've gone for the title. And there's obviously a couple of references to the book in the film, but when you hear the title Les Misérables, you do just imagine something really miserable. And whilst it's kind of like, it is grim and it is sort of tough, it is very, very tense and very watchful at the same time.
And there's some really sort of horrible dark humour in it, the sort of the things that they say to each other. It's a hard watch, but it's not something that feels like homework. It is thrilling to watch, don't you think?
Yeah, I think Elijah Lee recognised that it also needed to entertain. It didn't need to be a lecture. And I think he really delivers on that entertaining side of it, because you don't come away from the film feeling like you just sat, you know, in front of a dry blackboard presentation. You feel spent just from how exhausting this whole situation is.
You know, somebody says at the beginning that it's going to be 35 degrees today, and it is sort of immersive. It sort of feels like it is hot and sweaty, and you really feel like all the sounds and the smells and the tastes of Paris in it. It's very sort of transporting in that way as well. And the music is great as well. I found the music really sort of stirring and great, and at some points almost floating and dreamlike above this sort of area of Paris, that the shots, drone shots obviously, of sort of above, and this sort of floating idea of looking down at this sort of mess below. Just really a really interesting film. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
same.
Okay, so I think we're probably saying we highly recommend Les Misérables. We probably should recommend it in song, but we're not going to.
I don't have Hugh Jackman's lungs, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I can't do Amanda Seyfried, so that's over. Okay, so that is out in cinemas from the 4th of September. So we suggest having a nice French meal before you go and watch that and see how you get on. Okay, shall we move on to something completely inside somebody else's head? Let's go into Charlie Kaufman's world with this.
Jake, my boyfriend.
It's snowing.
Winter is coming in.
We have a real connection. A rare and intense attachment. I've never experienced anything like it. I'm thinking of ending things.
Huh?
What?
Did you say something?
I don't think so.
Weird.
Okay, so that is I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which is Charlie Kaufman's new film. Is it possible to explain what this is about, Matt?
Yes, I think it is, especially to begin with. So, yeah, as you mentioned, this is Charlie Kaufman writing and directing again. It's his first project since Anomalisa, which was in 2015, and he co-directed that with Duke Johnson. And so it's his first solo directing gig since Cynic Docu New York in 2008. And it's adapted from a novel by Ian Reid. I hadn't read the book, but it kind of surprised me when I learned it was adapted, because it does feel so Kaufman-esque in its own way. And it's almost feels odd that he's adapted it from another source. But it tells the story of a young woman played by Jessie Buckley from Wild Rose. And she's off to meet the parents of her boyfriend. And her boyfriend's played by Jesse Plemons. And the film starts when they're driving to his parents' farmhouse. And all the locations in the film are quite confined. So you spend a lot of time in the car and then a lot of time in the farmhouse. And the first kind of little taste of weirdness you get is very early on. We hear a lot of her internal monologue. And she sort of frequently says she's thinking of ending things. And it's almost as if her partner, played by Jesse Plemons, hears what she says at one point. Yeah. And so that's the first kind of like weird little, like, oh, what's going on here? From then on, things progressively and slowly get weirder as they go to his parents' farmhouse. His parents are played by Tony Collette and David Thewlis. And it's sort of, to me, especially this segment, it almost sort of feels like a David Lynch version of the sort of awkward dinner party subgenre of things like, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, that kind of thing.
I haven't seen this. All I've seen is the trailer, but it looked as though there were time loops a la Tenet going on, with different identities and people in different time zones and seeing people at different stages in their lives. Is that what it's really about, Jordan?
Well, that would be a spoiler to say, so I'm not going to talk about that. But I will say that the comparison to Tenet isn't without merit, because I think this and Tenet are probably the two most sort of mind-bending films I've seen this year. If you're planning to watch both of these in the same week, you might want to like plan
have a lie down
break.
After. Yeah,
because it is a real it's a real mindfuck. Yeah, I really like this. I actually like this a lot as kind of a mystery, just trying to work out what the hell was going on. Because Kaufman does a really good job of not playing his hand too soon. Especially during the the farm sequence, this kind of meet the parents sequence, because so much weird stuff happens. People just walk in wearing different outfits, very subtle differences. Food just magically appears on tables. Dogs are like randomly shaking for seemingly minutes at a time. It's just all this weird stuff that you're just trying to comprehend what the hell is going on. But then at the same time, you do have the emotional underpinning of this story between this couple whose relationship is kind of on the rocks, and this woman who's known as the young woman in the credits, doesn't actually have a character name. She's trying to come up with the best possible way to tell Jake, Jesse Plemons's character, how she wants to end things. And it was really compelling to me, just going down this spiral of weirdness. It can feel indulgent at points, but for the most part, I was really compelled. And it always felt like I was in a safe pair of hands, like he was actually taking me somewhere where I thought I would get answers by the end.
And do you get answers by the end?
Well, again, spoilers.
I don't want you to tell me what they are, but did you feel it came to a satisfying conclusion? Was it worth that headache at the beginning in order to get to the end?
I was mostly satisfied by the ending. The ending, again, not to go into too many details, is the most sort of obtuse and metaphorical element of the entire film. Like, compared to the first two thirds of the film, the final sequence is just dreamlike and very strange. But for me, there were clear interpretations that I took away from it, which I did find satisfying.
The ending, like Jordan says, it gets very surreal, but that's one element that really, really has stuck with me. And it is just in general, the film really stuck with me a lot. And I thought about it a lot after I'd seen it. And it was one of those films, I rewatched it again, like literally the next day, I think, because it was just one of those films I just wanted to kind of dive back into and take another look at. So I'd say that's another kind of plausible Tenet comparison, in that it is that kind of film you do just want to see again. And so as it's Netflix, it's, you know, you can just watch it again. And another thing which I found very mysterious about it, as well as just how everything's unfolding, and these weird things. It's just, you don't even really know what genre you're in a lot of the time, because it's kind of, it verges on horror in places, like never full horror, but like it's quite unsettling at times. But then it's also very funny at times. And like there's some bits, like some bits with David Thewlis, because Jesse Buckley's character is like an artist and they're having some sort of awkward dinner table chat about art. And just some of the stuff he was coming out with, I was just in absolute hysterics.
David Thewlis is hilarious in this film. Just some of his weird like grimaces and gurns. I was just cracking up.
He's always dependably good, isn't he? Yeah. And this is Jesse Buckley as well, who's obviously been on this, you know, amazing ride over the last sort of year or so. She's been in so many films suddenly, as it does seem to happen, that you suddenly see them in a whole batch of great performances. Does this really capitalize on the sort of promise that she was showing with things like Wild Rose?
Yeah, absolutely. It was actually a little bit of trivia. It was meant to be Brie Larson in this role, but she had to drop out just before filming for scheduling reasons, I believe. Jesse Buckley actually came into this film with very short notice, which makes it all the more impressive that she's done such a good job with it. Some of the stuff that she has to do, she has what must be pages and pages long monologues that she has to deliver. And she does it with so much passion and intensity. And it's basically just her talking to the ether, and it's quite remarkable and amazing. She plumbs some real sort of depths here.
Mm. And so if we're looking at this in comparison to other Kaufman things, where does it sort of scale in the sort of scheme of things? Is it on the very weird end? I mean, I love Being John Malkovich. Is it in that sort of end? Is it in the comfort zone? Where are we with this one?
I would say in the very weird end, in the sense it's very sort of knotty, and like those films like Being John Malkovich and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and films like that, they've got a very clear, catchy hook that's, you know, an easy to relate to kind of premise that is a fun way to draw you in. Whereas this is perhaps almost a bit tougher in that sense. It is a bit of a harder sell, but it is very rewarding when you stick with it.
And I think the fact that he has adapted it from, you know, a best-selling novel, which is a lot more straightforward than the film he's actually made. So there is a through line there you can definitely follow. I don't think it's anywhere near as impenetrable as Synecdoche, New York was for me.
Yeah, because that one I was just like, make this end. I could not even be bothered with the challenge of that, I'm afraid.
I struggled with that a little bit, but it was sort of on a level with Anomalisa for me. Like it's definitely weird, but there are things you can grasp onto which make it more than worthwhile.
So we're saying it's challenging, but it is worth that challenge.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, so that is I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which is on Netflix from this Friday. So that's all the time we have for this week, but please listen to our Christopher Nolan special podcast, which is counting down all his films in ranking order, and please go and see Tenet and come back and listen to our special spoiler cast. Before we go, though, we've got to answer a reader's question. Are you ready, boys? What's the best outfit from a movie that you'd like in your wardrobe? Jordan, what would you fancy having a swish around the room in?
I mean, it's kind of a boring and obvious one, but I'd love one of Bond's like Tom Ford tuxes or something. Like, that'd just be a nice thing to have in my wardrobe for any formal events I need to go to.
Pretty much all of John David Washington's outfits in Tenet and Robert Pattinson's as well. Just some of those suits. Like, I love the suit that the protagonist is wearing the first time he meets Andre Sator, that kind of red sort of suit.
Very nice.
Obviously, I would look nowhere near as cool as John David in it, but, you know, one can dream.
Come on, boys, anything fantastical.
I mean, if we're talking like completely impractical things where I would just get a lot of stares on the street, it would be cool to have like Boba Fett's armor or something, purely because I'd have a jetpack to be able to fly around wherever I needed to get.
Yeah.
And also the helmet would be very practical during the era of COVID because I wouldn't have to wear a mask.
Exactly. Face screened. What about you, Matt?
I'd love like a made to measure bat suit as well. One that, you know, the costume designer's made specifically for you. That'd be pretty cool to like look in the mirror wearing that. See what it's like.
Whose bat suit though? Are you going for
which bat suit?
Clooney bat nips.
Yeah, full nips.
Full nips. Just to sit and watch things on Netflix in. Be very uncomfortable. If I was going for an outfit, I think Keira Knightley's green silk dress in Atonement is a beauty. Sadly, I don't think it would look as wonderful on me as it does on her. But also, you know, I'd love to have Indiana Jones's hat. Just sort of put that on and walk around in that.
The hat.
Yeah, I'm not into the jacket. I feel like that might be a bit
smelly. With the Atonement dress.
Yes, those two things together. And also, I think I'd probably just love one of the Elizabeth I outfits from Elizabeth, one of Kate Blanchett's amazing outfits with the huge collar and the waspish waist and just loads of trains, which I can regally walk around my kitchen in. Just, you know, make a bit of pasta whilst dressed in that. I think it would be amazing.
I also really liked Kay's coat in Blade Runner 2049. I want one of those. Yeah, looks like it'd be real cozy.
Mm-hmm. You can't do it up though. Just wear it casually open. Obviously, oh, yeah.
I'd have a cold chest then.
Mm.
I just remembered mine, which I actually did find in the wild, which was the John Krasinski dad jumper in A Quiet Place.
I had forgotten that. Yes, you did find that.
That has to be my answer. Yeah.
But you've already got that. You've not got the actual jumper, but you have a very good approximation, and we all enjoy it when you wear that into the office. You know, Matt does have a beard, not as lush as John's, but we do feel a little bit safer, don't we, if there was an alien invasion when he's wearing that jumper. So it's a good one.
I also have several of Scott Pilgrim's t-shirts from the film, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I basically wear jeans and trainers most of my life. So I essentially cosplay Scott Pilgrim every day.
Yeah. There's no shame in that. Okay. So I think that's all we have time for, boys. Shall we say goodbye?
Bye.
Bye.
I'm 260 for my shirt. 260 for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.